about to take part in a time-traveling road trip through the highs and lows of pop culture. A road trip with a clear destination and many stops along the way. This is but one act of one chapter of the serialized journey.
So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to, well, we've warned you.
We own the heat. That honky pig Bert could keep us.
Oh, I miss the word honky.
When we last left off, we began the six-year odyssey of Cinematic Titanic, the traveling Wilburys of movie riffing, a group that consisted of Joel Hodgson, Mary Jo Peel, Josh J. Elvis Weinstein, Frank Conniff, and Trace Beaulieu. In covering their first seven home video releases, we detailed vague shadowy conspiracies, toy tank silhouettes, death-defying game shows, a return to both Mars and the North Pole, Wasp Women, and Legacies of Blood. This week, we say goodbye to the studio with the last efforts of the group. Five superb live shows chock full of alien visitations, blaxploitation, military-grade rattlesnakes, and even danger on Tiki Island. As always, I am Ryan Luis Rodriguez, and you are stuck with the Coolness Chronicles Season 1, the history and legacy of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and this is Chapter 14, Extracurricular Activities.
Episode
Nanotated Time Tubes, Part 2. When Cinematic Titanic was formed in 2007, it wasn't strictly a home video-based enterprise. Live shows were an integral part, not just for the energy factor that a hungry crowd provides, but also to fine-tune material. The very first quote-unquote episode, Brain of Blood or The Oozing Skull, was shot in studio on December 4th of that year, but had its release delayed until the end of the month to incorporate popular riffs from a private show at Industrial Light and Magic just a few days later on the 7th. The Wasp Woman went before live audiences 2 months before its studio recording. Same with Frankenstein's Castle of Freaks. For Blood of the Vampires, it was 5 months. The format was largely the same for each show, with Dave Gruber-Allen frequently kicking things off as the warm-up act. In the beginning, there was some indecision on how to present the material. Silhouettes don't necessarily work in a live environment, not to mention the multi-level approach from the studio records, so it took on more of an MST3K vibe. For the second show, the participants sat in the front row of the theater, but by the third show they were sitting on stage with the movie, at least partially lit. By the time 2009 rolled around, the setup superficially resembled the studio setup. With the theater screen in the center, either side was flanked with orchestra risers. On the right, from top to bottom, Trace, Joel, and Mary Jo, and Josh and Frank on the left, all facing the screen. After Blood of the Vampires, the seventh release, was released on DVD on March 19, 2009, there was every intention to keep the studio format going, but to break it up with live releases, which did away with the High Concept Institute and time tubes and whatnot, as well as the film breaks. In retrospect, these Cinematic Titanic live shows had much in common with Riff Trax's live shows, which coincidentally began the same year. But the studio shows never resumed, likely due to three factors. One, it was comparatively costly to rent the facility. Two, most of the performers lived in different states, and scheduling was a concern. And three, they had a great track record live. People seemed to dig it, so why mess with success? Although the studio records were large and ambitious, clever, and nostalgic, they also didn't land upon a cohesive narrative, which could have been entirely intentional. I don't know. I've seen each episode at least 5 times, and I still can't tell what is supposed to be vague or confusing and what isn't. With live shows, there's an instant call and response. You know what's working as you say it, and you don't have to wait a few months and read a message board to figure out the hit ratio. You can feed off the energy. energy that grants you permission to be spontaneous. And since MST3K had remained an evergreen obsession for countless fans even two decades later, you have built-in audiences that were already waiting to see you. Frankly, the live shows, all five of them, are superior to the studio recordings, not just in atmosphere, but in terms of the actual movie's rift. So let's get into it. Depending on who you ask, Al Adamson did not make a lot of good movies before his life was tragically cut short in 1995, or after, for that matter. That was in really bad taste, and I apologize. That's not to say that his movies weren't beloved by cinema fans. If anything proves this, it's the 32-film box set of his films that Severin put out last year, which also includes a great documentary on his life called Blood and Flesh. Hell, film history wouldn't be the same without Al Adamson. Cinematographers Laszlo Kovacs and Vilmos Zsigmond cut their teeth on Adamson productions, not to mention, actually, I can't think of anything else he's affected, but that's a big deal nonetheless. Like all exploitation mavens from Roger Corman on down, Adamson's great, gift was seizing on trends with his own grimy signature. When the Wild Angels kicked off an interest in biker movies, Adamson was there with Satan's sadists. Is Blazing Saddles a huge hit? Let's rename our unrelated sexploitation comedy Blazing Stewardesses, cause why the hell not? When Bruce Lee made the leap to American movie stardom with Enter the Dragon, released after he died of a brain hemorrhage, tragically, it opened the floodgates for Kung Fu Pictures. Suddenly, independent studios were snagging distribution rights to countless Hong Kong action movies for grindhouse theaters, and, in many cases, mainstream movie houses. Al Adamson took note of this, and in a moment of genius or insanity, thought, you know what? Blaxploitation movies are big money. What if I do a half and half? I'm not really good at either genre, but it's still a chocolate and peanut butter combo. The result was 1974's Dynamite Brothers, also known as Stud Brown, riffed under the title East Meets Watts.
His name, Stud Brown.
Stud Brown's gonna take care of you.
And he's the baddest news in town. But don't cross him, because once you do, there's nowhere on earth you can hide.
Brother, please, I didn't mean to!
Stud Brown. He packs the biggest rod in town. Rated R.
This interracial buddy action flick, predating Rush Hour by a few decades, follows Larry Chin, a martial arts master from China who illegally arrives in San Francisco searching for his long-lost brother. Unfortunately for Larry, the corrupt police are waiting for him, and he's quickly arrested and shackled to the wrist of another man, Soul Brother Stud Brown, who doesn't actually get a proper introduction before being thrown into the plot and immediately confronted with spit-take-inducing racist scorn.
Now don't get sore at me, Burke. We picked him up on an L.A. warrant. You hear that, nigga? You've been wasting the penny for his time. Are you sorry?
Larry and Stud quickly escape and head to Los Angeles, where Larry's brother was last seen, and use their feet and fists to take on the Chinese mob, which just so happens to be run by, dun-dun-dun, Larry's brother. Along the way, there is some surprisingly well-choreographed karate, undone by incompetent direction, some questionable romance, non-existent chemistry, and more continuity errors than seems humanly possible. I don't recall anyone involved confirming an explicit connection, but I feel like this was a huge influence for Black Dynamite.
Dynamite! Dynamite!
But that's a story for season 2, a story that I cannot fucking wait to tell you. Anyway, Al Adamson fleshed out this, story much the same way that most exploitation directors did. First, you find your washed-up stars that aren't going to reject your very low offers. In this case, the big name is Aldo Ray, whose heyday as a leading man ended when Columbia Pictures didn't renew his contract in 1958. He subsequently spent the next 3 decades taking what he could get, which is why we're talking about him today. East Meets Watts is really the quintessential typecast role for Ray, the gruff and grumbly, possibly perpetually drunk, corrupt police detective. By casting someone like Ray, even though they're not in the movie very much, you have a name to put on a poster or encourage a theater owner to rent your movie. With that secured, you go for your lower wattage leads. In this case, he got Timothy Brown, who spent 8 seasons with the Philadelphia Eagles before transitioning into acting, and Carol Speed as his love interest, perhaps best known as the titular character in Abby, the blaxploitation ripoff of The Exorcist, co-starring Blackula himself, William Marshall.
Hear me, demon! Leave this woman body!
Abby, rated R.
You also have to get some established character actors in there. And for the leader of the Chinese mob, Adamson got James Hong, which is where this movie goes so very right. Any study of modern cinema eventually gets around to James Hong. Prolific is too inadequate a word for him. Over the past 50 years, he has appeared in more than 500 films and television shows. He's one of the voices in the American cut of the original Godzilla. He's in Colossus the Forbin Project, The Sand Pebbles, Chinatown, The In-Laws, Airplane, Ninja 3, The Domination, The Golden Child, Tango and Cash. He's Hannibal Chu in Blade Runner. He's Kung Fu Panda's dad. He's Lo Pan in Big Trouble in Little China.
They have survived the burning blade and tamed the savage heart.
The Chinese-American Christopher Lee is in East Meets Watts. There, now you know this movie is amazing. Easily the very best of not just the live shows, but of the entire run. And saving it for a live show was the smartest possible decision. You see, part of the joy of Cinematic Titanic Live is knowing that at any random show in any possible American city, there are going to be misties in the audience. People who had their senses of humor defined by this kind of comedy, who know the in-jokes and callbacks like the backs of their hands. These performers know that they have a shorthand with a decent percentage of the attendees, and they can hit those notes like virtuosos. In each of the 5 live shows, there are a few moments of self-reference, and my absolute favorite pops up in East Meets Watts. Allow me to provide some context. Director Al Adamson's depiction of the Chinese mob was rather unorthodox. According to him, the Chinese mob was the one that punished trespassers by throwing them in a crevasse and dumping rattlesnakes on them out of a basket. If you listen to true crime podcasts, what typically happens when you fuck with the mafia is they break your legs. Simple, elegant, gets the message across. But this is a movie. You have room to dream. Add the fact that China is practically a different country than America, one that we probably haven't visited, and you have even more leeway to get creative with punishments. Knowing all of this creative freedom, the best he could come up with was rattlesnakes in a crevasse. It's kinda cute. Novel, in a way. Anyway, a snake is present, so during the riff, Joel says,
"Hey, Trace, watch out for snakes, okay?"
Ega. The audience gets it. They dig it. Pretty decent response. Shortly thereafter, Trace returns the favor.
"Hey, Joel, rock climbing."
"Thank you."
"Hey, Trace, pandering."
And feeding off the audience's reaction isn't just limited to MST references. There's a give and take that even though you don't know how people will react to a joke in the moment, if you play your cards right, you can translate even a lukewarm reception into a bigger laugh. And about 1/3 into the show, Frank Conniff does just that.
"Lie, Ruby, not Ruby.
She's Ruby Truesdale.
Don't you give me any more static and I'll
love you. And you'll do nothing.
How dare you judge me?
You want the pay all you."
The next live show release comes from a director with an unintended connection to MST3K. Don Doler was a horse of many colors. A small-scale science fiction director devoted to his native habitat of Maryland, an underground cartoonist, and an influential independent magazine publisher. His handmade alien monster movies have secured a devoted fan base, albeit likely for reasons he didn't intend, which is on brand, considering that his greatest exposure to genre fans was an unlicensed repurposing of his work. I'll explain. Back in season 3 of MST3K, Joel and the Bots covered many movies from disreputable distributor Film Ventures International, who would pay to license clips from one movie, less expensive than a wholesale purchase, only to use the whole picture anyway. Then they would create new opening credits using stolen footage from a different movie and copyright their new edit as a separate picture. For the 3rd and best episode of that season, Pod People, the new opening credits were from Don Doler's charmingly cheap 1985 film, The Galaxy Invader. Though it wasn't remarked upon in the episode, the fact that the opening credits didn't match the actual feature has become part of the series lore. So essentially, in fact, that Riff Tracks finally cover the entirety of Galaxy Invader, which we'll discuss in the next chapter. Cinematic Titanic, however, decided to turn back the clock and riff a different charmingly cheap Don Doler alien monster movie, his very first, in fact, shot in 1972 and left to languish on a shelf until 1978. It's the Alien Factor. Let me try to break this one down. A spaceship containing three alien specimens meant for an intergalactic zoo crash lands in the snowy woods outside Pennsylvania. But this ain't no bullcrap E.T. or Starman scenario. These aliens are not here to teach us about the delicate balance of life and death or to treat our plants with more respect. They're here to eat people and shit them out in that order. First, we have the Zagatile, an 8-foot-tall furry monstrosity that's part Chewbacca, part Harryhausen Cyclops, part satyr, part walrus, with either mandibles or tusks, part spider, all wonderful. Josh describes him as a Tootsie Roll that fell on a barbershop floor, and I think that's a pretty accurate description. There's also the Inferbice, a crustacean-like armor-plated creature with a head not unlike the Sakaarans in the first Guardians of the Galaxy, and the Lemoid, a stop-motion sleestak with a mohawk of horns and an adorably goofy overbite. Thankfully, even though the local sheriff and his podunk cronies are no match for these creatures, obviously since their kill count ranges in the double digits, there is another, nicer alien that steps in at the last minute and dispatches the bad ones. Because his natural form looks like a skinned werewolf, he uses cosmic energy straight out of a Nelvana cartoon to transform into a human. Specifically, a regular patron at the local watering hole with a groovy mustache. That summary makes it sound like a lot happens in the picture, which is sadly not the case. Like many other movies riffed on MST3K or Cinematic Titanic or even Riff Tracks, it suffers from an interest deficiency.
You know, the problem with our particular style of humor, this riffing thing, is that sometimes people are just walking through the goddamn woods.
Fortunately for Don Doler, when it comes to independent homemade monster movies, you're not judged on your story construction, you're judged on your monsters. And while none of these monsters are remotely scary or convincing, they're very creative. The Zagatile in particular has long legs that were likely built on stilts, and you have to give it up to any performer that would wear these cumbersome things and attempt to even chase another actor in the snow with the entire costume in frame. None of the non-alien actors are very good, all character interactions are about as stiff as an industrial film, but you could say the same thing about low-budget monster epics like 1970s Equinox. The difference is that Dennis Muren, who co-directed Equinox, later became one of the most influential visual effects supervisors of the modern era, and his film basically inspired The Evil Dead. Don Doler, on the other hand, later made something called Night Beast. You know what? Now that I think about it, both legacies are valid. Something rather minor that is rather major to me, since everything Doler did was locally sourced, there's a scene in the middle of the film set in the watering hole that I mentioned a few minutes ago, for which the director wanted a band. He apparently knew a singer-songwriter named Lon Talbot, who had a band called Atlantis. Talbot agreed to appear in the film and sing a song of his called Maybe Someday, which I played at the top of the episode. I've never heard a single positive reaction to Atlantis in subsequent reviews of The Alien Factor, but I genuinely love that song. Unfortunately, just as the movie was put on the shelf, Atlantis' only pressed record was also prevented from release. The record was a single, with Maybe Someday as the B-side. The A-side was a song called Moby Shark, and the artwork of, you'll never believe it, a shark, was deemed so similar to the poster for Jaws that Universal Pictures withheld its release. Unlike The Alien Factor, which did see some form of a second life, there were only 100 copies of the record pressed, and it was never commercially released. The Alien Factor eventually became a cable staple in the 80s, getting major circulation on Ted Turner's TBS, aka the Superstation, so I can't claim that it's a genuine cinematic Titanic discovery. But it is a perfect example of the kind of contradictory movie that brings out the best in our riffers. There is both so much delightfully weird stuff to process and so much disastrous incompetence that it's easy to love and loathe in equal measure. which provides those tasked with riffing it different opportunities. You can mock the monsters all you want, but when suddenly nothing happens for two entire minutes, your boredom allows you to get brilliant moments like this.
I'm really sorry, you guys. This is really hard for me to watch. It just hits a little too close to home. I walked through a snowy woods once.
Moving on. The next recorded live show has neither enough weird stuff to process, nor the enjoyable kind of incompetence. It was called Brides of Blood from 1968, riffed under the name Danger on Tiki Island. Like last week's Blood of the Vampires, it was another example of Filipino horror from co-director Gerardo de Leon. And, like Blood of the Vampires, it is a slog. It's about some Americans investigating atomic bomb radiation in the tropics, who visit an island known as Blood Island, where the locals regularly sacrifice virgins to their mutated murderous plant life. As I rewatched it last week for this podcast, I tried to take note of all the things that I found interesting in the movie. And this is what I came up with. Menacing butterfly on a string, tiki idol that looks like Groucho Marx, and I'm spent. However boring and surprisingly uneventful it is, the riffs are solid and the live audience seems to dig it. I think. Either the show was recorded strangely or mixed poorly in post-production, because while you hear a light, consistent wave of laughter underneath the movie's bombastic sound design, it's garbled. And garbled audience response on a live show is deathly, because it feels like a subconscious laugh track. You can see the performers feeding off the reaction to a joke, but you can't hear the reaction itself, which is disorienting. I start wondering, why didn't that riff land? It was perfect! And then quickly realize, maybe I just can't hear it. Throughout the entire show, I wanted to hear these performers get the reception that they deserved, and this isn't the right way to convey that. Thankfully, it's an issue that is unique to this particular movie. The next live show hailed from a different part of Asia, the island country of Japan, and had more batshit craziness in its fingernail than Danger on Tiki Island had in its entire body. Also from 1968, Genocide, aka War of the Insects. The Shochiko Company is one of the oldest studios in the Japanese film industry, having released its first picture as early as 1920. They were the first to adopt techniques and styles from America, like talking pictures, which necessitated the construction of the first soundstage in Japan. By the end of the 50s, however, they were considered likely the most old-fashioned major studio, steering clear of genre movies and appealing primarily to female audiences, which I would think is a good thing. In the late 60s, facing severe competition from their rivals like Toho and the increasing popularity of television, they dove headfirst into sci-fi and kaiju pictures with four movies in quick succession, starting with 1967's The X from Outer Space and ending with Genocide, which is considered part of the kaiju subgenre, despite all of its monsters being very tiny. You know the phrase, too many cooks? Well, Genocide is an example of too many plots. Here is the most concise summary I was able to find. A hydrogen bomb is lost on an island south of Japan after the bomber carrying it flies into a huge swarm of insects and crashes. Three crew members eject, but two of them are later found dead of strange wounds, while the other is found to be in a coma. A local man named George is blamed for the deaths and quickly taken into custody. Scientist Nagumo travels from mainland Japan to try and help prove his innocence. Military men from the United States appear and hinder Nagumo's efforts in their ruthless search to find the lost H-bomb. But there are communist agents working on the island who also want the bomb. Soon both they and the Americans are vying for possession of the weapon. Meanwhile, a lone female scientist and survivor of Nazi concentration camps, convinced that man's destructive tendencies must be put to an immediate and permanent end, plots the destruction of all mankind through the release of swarms of new and deadly insect species. In the end, the bomb is detonated and the island is destroyed along with all who knew about the deadly insects, which escape into the skies. I know what you're thinking. It all sounds rather self-explanatory. Now take something else into consideration. Although it sounds like enough material for an incoherent miniseries, all of this happens in 84 minutes. You will barely be able to keep up with the Nashville of killer bug movies, but the riffers in Cinematic Titanic don't have that issue. Actually, that's not true. They have no idea what's going on either, but they do make it funny, or I suppose, funnier.
It's the first time in my life I've ever heard about this. It's weird.
And I'm Japanese, and I know some weird shit.
The downside to silhouettes is the lack of definition. They're visually striking, But sometimes a performer's facial expression can convey a joke better than the words that they're actually saying. That's the upside to these live shows. Although there are no audience cutaways, the positive feedback is reflected in the performer's faces. If one of the five gets a particularly huge laugh, you can see the other four react with pride or amusement. Like all the live shows, genocide kills, and that massacre of laughter injects and infuses the riffs and their delivery. The best recordings of live comedy are like a contact high, even when divorced from both time and space. You don't have to know where or even when it was captured. It just works. The next live show requires a bit of personal information on my part. Actually, it doesn't, but I want to tell you anyway. If I were to lay out my four main fears, the fears that I consider and cower from on a daily basis, they would be, in ascending order, death, other people, heights, and snakes. I can explain the bottom two, but any attempt to deduce the top two has failed miserably. It's not really a problem with heights. If I don't want to have a panic attack, I can just avoid tall structures. But with snakes, it's this irrational, ever-present dread. They can appear literally anywhere, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. I know that's not technically true, but it feels like it is. It doesn't even matter what kind of snake. I once had an encounter with a timid garden snake on a sidewalk with 50 feet between us, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack. Conversely, the second place I go during every visit to a zoo is the reptile house, to stare at the snakes and tell myself reassuringly that if they ever escaped their glass prison, I would heroically stomp them out. I probably wouldn't. By the way, the first place that I go during every visit to the zoo? The nearest quick service restaurant. I don't know where my fear of snakes started, but I think it's attributable to my having seen Raiders of the Lost Ark on VHS with my aunt when I was 4 or 5, and my being traumatized by the Well of Souls sequence. That entire section of the film is etched onto my consciousness to this day, and I feel like it works on me the way that the genital amputation in Cannibal Holocaust works on real men. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter why I'm afraid of and somehow also drawn to snakes. I just am, and it's something that never goes away. For years, when I went to sleep, I checked under the bed for snakes, and I wasn't just a little kid, I was a teenager. In my defense, we had lizards under every bush in the neighborhood, and if you saw rustling, chances are it was a reptile. Even though I don't recall ever seeing a snake during said rustling, I always told myself, next time, when you least expect it, there'll be a rattler. There never was, at least as far as I can recall, but that mentality persisted. If I were ever in the jungle with a companion and they were bitten by a snake, I would leave them to die rather than risk a sneak attack from another nearby serpent. Sorry, Mom. The last ever cinematic Titanic release, recorded in 2012, taps directly into my deeply disturbing irrational fear to create the scariest movie I have ever seen. From 1976, a most unnerving way to celebrate the bicentennial, Rattlers.
This is Rattlers, a tale of terror. This is Rattlers. What a way to die. Rattlers. Thrills, excitement, death. Rattlers.
Rattlers sprang from the fertile and disturbed mind of writer, producer, director John McCauley, who manages to take the most unnerving aspects of nature-run-amok movies, combined with a polemic against the careless destruction by the military-industrial complex, all covered with a rich cream consisting of the terrifying unprofessionalism of zero-budget filmmaking. Allow me to explain. Sam Chu, who also appeared in the MST3K episode Time Walker, aka Being from Another Planet, stars as Dr. Tom Parkinson, a herpetologist, aka a cold sore scientist, who is summoned to an army base adjacent small town in the California desert to determine why two kids were massacred by rattlesnakes. Sidebar. Even though his name conjures mental images of old-timey cowboys or skull tobacco, Sam Chu looks like a young George Plimpton. I don't believe he has ever rodeoed once in his life. End sidebar. Dr. Parkinson begins to realize during the course of an investigation that this rattlesnake attack is not an isolated incident, and may in fact be somehow related to the Army base's activities. Dr. Parkinson pieces this together in tandem with his obligatory love interest, a war photographer named Anne Bradley, who looks like Ally McGraw impersonating Talia Shire. As Dr. Parkinson and Ms. Bradley chase snakes and deepen their personal connections, depicted through an abruptly timed montage of quirky falling in love cliches, it becomes clear that the Army base's commanding officer, Colonel Stroud, is responsible for illegally dumping a volatile nerve gas, CT3, in a nearby cave, which has made the local snake population super aggressive. As Stroud starts burning the documents proving his misdeeds in a trash can fire in his office,
yeah, let's see WikiLeaks get a hold of this.
His chief medical officer, Captain Delaney, drunkenly accosts him and is shot in the chest for his valiant, alcohol-soaked efforts. But our villain doesn't get away scot-free. In an attempt to hide more CT3 canisters in the nearby cave, he is blown up by his own grenade, which also incinerates all the nerve gas and all the snakes, question mark?
This shot tells you one thing. Some dipshit actually thought there might be a sequel.
Because Rattlers was a very low-budget production, it's unlikely that many stunt doubles were used for scenes involving snakes, and, given the title, it may surprise you to discover that there are a lot of scenes with snakes in them. The cold open, where two Muppets no older than 12 are sneak attacked by rattlesnakes, does not appear to be fake. I don't know if it involved trick angles or defang snakes, but even with both, it's almost unbearable to watch. Even worse is a scene where a young woman takes a gratuitous yet nudity-free bubble bath, which is then interrupted when a rattlesnake enters the tub through a hole where the faucet should be. If that sounds vaguely familiar, it's because the same scene occurred in Wes Craven's 1981 flop Deadly Blessing, which Craven then repurposed for an iconic moment in Nightmare on Elm Street. Was Wes consciously quoting Rattlers? Probably not, but I'll accuse him of it anyway. He certainly can't defend himself, but seriously, RIP. For snake apologists, Rattler is probably a subpar creature feature, but for those that truly understand the nefarious nature of those slithery satanic serpents, at least according to your Earth Bible, it's still terrible, but packed to the scales with fresh horror. I will watch it countless more times in the years to come, unless some sneaky snake does me in first. As I mentioned earlier, when it dropped in July of 2012, Rattlers was Cinematic Titanic's swan song, at least in terms of physical home video releases. The Five Riffers continued to tour into 2013, although Josh missed a few dates as he was in the middle of cancer treatments that he's thankfully since recovered from, and the tour concluded on December 30th with a farewell double feature of The Wasp Woman and a movie that never made it to DVD, The Doll Squad. Though the end of Cinematic Titanic is frequently described as a breakup, a more appropriate word would be disbandment, a mutual decision not made out of apathy, but out of living considerations. Over their 6 years of collaborative riffing, Josh, Joel, Trace, Mary Jo, and Frank had gone from living in three different parts of the country to living in five, which made the scheduling of both writing and performing more logistically difficult. There may have also been some desire to tackle new obstacles, not unlike the end of MST3K, where Sci-Fi Channel's cancellation was a primary concern that came as those involved had reached a creative plateau. But just because Cinematic Titanic was no more, it didn't mean that it was the end of collaboration altogether. Trace and Frank decided to go back on the road in 2015 for a new live movie riffing endeavor called The Mads Are Back, tackling subjects as diverse as Ed Wood's Glenn or Glenda, the third Black Lagoon movie The Creature Walks Among Us, William Castle's The Tingler, and even La La Land. They actually stopped by my other podcast, Reels of Justice, to talk about the tour, which is now streaming due to the pandemic, and it was one of the great, yet terrifying honors of my recent life. Around the same time, they launched a recently concluded podcast with Carolina Hidalgo called Movie Sign with the Mads that we're going to discuss on a future Patreon episode. Josh also became a podcaster for a weekly show with pal Andy Kindler called Thought Spiral, in addition to becoming director of great documentaries like I Need You to Kill and Who Do You Want Me to Be, both of which are streaming on Amazon. In 2016, Mary Jo and Trace attempted to produce a crowdsourced television pilot called Renfest, which, if funded, would be a satirical yet affectionate mockumentary set at a Renaissance festival inspired by Parks and Recreation. It would star the two riffers with a supporting role for Dave Gruber Allen and cameos from Frank, Josh, Mike Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Bill Corbett.
If we can give the children an authentic Renaissance experience, if we can make this world come alive for them, I think we have a real chance to save America.
Sadly, it did not make its funding goal, and it seemed to be dead in the water for a few years, but the proof of concept work was accepted into the Catalyst Content Festival in 2019, renewing interest in the project, although there have been no concrete updates since October of last year. I am keeping my fingers crossed, though. Mary Jo moved from Renfest to YouTube in 2018, playing the title character of an amazing short-form series called Ruth Larson Lives, a parody of social media lifestyle vlogs, that's video blogs for all you Luddites, which she also wrote. Ruth is always quick to dole out advice that no one solicited, and advice that is probably just two aphorisms accidentally fused together. Not content to be one note, the series doubles as a smart character study, one that someone much cleverer than I once compared to Maria Schneider's Jean Teasdale column in The Onion, and I don't think I could conjure a better compliment.
Here's the thing, this is an exciting new development in my life because I believe in that saying in the Bible, when life gives you lemons, God opens a window.
The whole first season is on YouTube in its entirety, and I hope it's coming back in some way and soon. Joel saw the end of Cinematic Titanic as an impetus to restart the clock on MST3K, which is something that you may have heard a tiny bit about in the last couple years. Not surprisingly, given the visual invention of these studio-based Cinematic Titanic episodes, the new MST3K incorporated several elements introduced in the former project. The nameless organization that seemingly held our five heroes hostage served as an inspiration for Kinga Forrester's Empire of Corporatized Media. Time tubes were shouted out by Dr. Donna St. Fibes towards the end of the gauntlet. And the concept of Kingachrome, a liquid movie storage system, had its origins in the cold open of the last studio episode of Cinematic Titanic, Blood of the Vampires.
I'm sorry we had to go the long way, but we got a data spill in Sector 4 and it's closed for cleanup.
A data spill?
Yeah, I'm not supposed to talk about it, but between you and me, there was a leak in the cupola tank and all three Godfathers seeped together. It's going to be a big distillation process.
Some of the crew also carried over, like Grant Pachoco, who started as a transcriber for Cinematic Titanic and transitioned to an associate producer before becoming the chief puppeteer for Crow and performed a new character, M. Waverly, as well. Looking over the six-year run of Cinematic Titanic, it's fitting that the whole enterprise began as a potential Mystery Science Theater reunion and blossomed into something that could and did stand on its own. It proved conclusively that the format established on the Satellite of Love was not a fluke, not dependent on adorably crude robots or sleepy-eyed men shanghaied in space, and proved this without actually setting out to prove anything. Its reign may have been relatively short, but its legacy is and will continue to be long-lasting, as long as Joel is involved with the ever-shifting incarnations of MST3K post-cancellation. It probably has something to do with those gosh darn time tubes. And that is where we end this episode of the Coolness Chronicles. If you're a fan of the show, $5 gets you access to not just early broadcasts of every episode, but hours of bonus content, like all the Goes to the Movies installments, and super fun weekly minisodes that spin off from these chapters exclusively at patreon.com/coolnesschronicles. This Friday, we're revisiting Ben Murphy, he who hath the fondness for turkey talk, as the Chronicles Reconsidered takes on the bootleg Invisibility Watch television series Gemini Man, one with a detour that you'll never guess unless you saw at least three trailers in a movie theater last year. It's going to be a fun change of pace. Starting next week, we'll wrap up December with some very fun crossover episodes. On the 15th, a clip show, but not of this podcast, a clip show of all the amazing stuff that we've done on Patreon this year From Invader Zim to Austin Powers to Digital Monkeys, Blair Witches, a chainsaw-wielding Bluto, Killdozers, and gallons of bad acid. On the 22nd, my good friend Nikki from my favorite YouTube show Trivial Theater will stop by for an engaging chat, and on the 29th, a huge big-time crossover with my other podcast, Reels of Justice, as Rob Maynor, Dylan Schlender, and Ben Haslar show up to quickly, irrevocably derail my efforts to organize the conversation. Then, when we return to regular episodes in January, we'll close out this chapter on extracurricular activities with the literary works of the cast and crew of MST3K. All that, and much, much more as we continue to chart the history and legacy of Mystery Science Theater 3000. But before we take off for the week, let's change gears a bit for the moment you've all been waiting for. It's Ryan's recommendations. I'm not terribly high on the found footage subgenre. We kind of went into it on the Blair Witch Project minisode on our Patreon page, and I'll lightly restate it here. Every film seems to be a competition to see who can look more aggressively amateurish than the last guy, but beneath the surface, they're too structured, too polished, too familiar. I grew up making movies. Bad ones. Really, really bad ones. So I know what actual amateurish home productions feel like, how things flow, or rather don't. And these movies don't really ring true to me. But today, I'm happy to say that I can recommend something that completely breaks that mold. From 2013, it's the WNUF Halloween special.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Yeah, well, no. Yes, I...
Yes, well, no.
Like friendly kinds, like happy ghosts. You know, like when your grandmother passes away, but you know, like my mom told me, you know, she would always be there and, you know, and she'll look after me. Like, that's like she's happy.
Yeah. And you believed her when she said that.
VCRs changed the viewing habits of media-hungry Americans in the mid to late 80s. We could turn this magical tape machine on, pick a channel, turn the TV off, and record hours of programming, then watch it back whenever we damn well pleased. But there was a significant drawback. Some of us could only afford the one-time purchase of this magical tape machine, but not the magical cord connected to the back of our televisions called cable. So we ended up recording a lot of stuff that we didn't actually want to watch. As DVD and later Blu-ray and now streaming decimated the VCR VHS community, sites like Everything is Terrible and the TV Carnage compilations cleverly culled through years of these forgotten relics of decaying videotape, reminding the strangest of us of the sublime lo-fi madness that we may have missed. In a similar, subtler vein, the WNUF Halloween special presents itself as, well, the Halloween Eve broadcast of a local Maryland news program from 1987, the centerpiece of which is the station's lead reporter initiating a séance in a haunted house. What we're watching is supposedly the raw tape of that special, a dupe of a dupe of a dupe, complete with all the commercial breaks, like innocuous ads for carpet warehouses and the like, and in-studio cutaways, like somebody put a tape in the VCR, set the clock, forgot about it, ejected it afterwards, threw it in their moldy basement, forgot about it for 3 decades, then traded it at some convention for $5 and a drink ticket, without ever thinking if it contained anything of note. By setting his sights on replicating the mundanity of local television and not exaggerating it, the conventional low-ambition advertising, the static two-camera setup news presentation, the poorly conducted man-on-the-street interviews, director Chris LaMartina has channeled something that most found footage movies don't. Plausibility. I've watched a lot of horror movies this year, and while I wouldn't say that this ranks very high on the list in terms of scares, it's very close to the top in terms of pure enjoyment. The WNUF Halloween special is streaming on Shudder. All year, I've been on a journey of cinematic discovery that I like to call the 2020 Project, watching a little bit of everything. Every decade, every genre, every. And you can see my progress at letterboxd.com/coolnesspodcast. Thank you to everyone involved in making MST3K for everything they've contributed to my life and to culture as a whole. Double thanks for writing the episode guide that I will quote frequently in this season of the pod. I also want to thank Shout Factory for their excellent supplemental material that was invaluable to my research for this and every episode to follow on this subject. If you want to support the artist who made Cinematic Titanic, the complete DVD collection is available on Amazon or directly from Shout Factory. And thank you for listening. If you enjoy what you hear, please rate and review the show on iTunes or your chosen source and share it with anyone you can, any way you can. This has been the largest and most fulfilling endeavor I've ever seen to completion, and it would be nice to keep making the show until it just isn't fun anymore. Have any questions or comments, or is there anything I missed in this particular chapter? Contact me on Twitter, at CoolnessPodRyan, Instagram, at The Coolness Chronicles, or on our Facebook page, and keep on the lookout for updates. Also, as I mentioned before, every Thursday I appear as a juror, or a prosecutor, or a judge, or a defendant, it's fluid, on Reels of Justice, a podcast where we put films literally on trial, determine if they're innocent or guilty of being a bad movie. It's a fantastic show with a similar sensibility, and if you like this pod, check it out. iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, etc. Special thanks to our amazing patrons, Michael H., Bill M., Christopher H., Mary M., Christopher J., Tracy R., The Vern, and Jenny R. Until next time, do what you love, don't be a dick, and take care.
Darn, that's the end.